Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. And we've not just got one guest for you today, we've got two. So this is going to be a great conversation. Welcome to the show, Mark and Jay.
Thank you, Simon. Lovely to meet you.
Really looking forward to this conversation. For me, it's part of my learning curve because usually we have the odd three-hander episode. And I love that opportunity to learn more and to bring you into the conversation as and when. So I'd love you if we could start with Mark. Can you introduce yourself to the listeners, and then we'll do the same with Jay.
Yep. So my name's Mark. I am an adoptive parent with my partner. He and I adopted together our first son about 16, 17 years ago when he was five. He's now 21, which is a little terrifying. And then a couple of years later, we adopted our second son from a different birth family, and he is going to be 19 this year. So we're coming out of the teen years. Steve and I were one of the first same-sex couples to adopt in Hertfordshire, where we both adopted. So that's been our adoption journey. And I'll just say very quickly how I know Jay. Jay and I both work for or volunteer as trustees and as volunteers for an organisation called We Are Family, which is a small charity based in London and the home counties, which is a peer-to-peer support charity for adopters and prospective adopters, where we aim to support people at any stage of their adoption journey, providing them with real support and connection to other people. So Jay, do you want to say hi?
I do want to say hi, but about We Are Family, it is free to join. There is no downside to joining. Okay. It's like free at the point of need, like the NHS is how I view it. So my name is Jay. I am also an adoptive parent, but I'm also a step parent and a birth parent. So my stepson is very grown up and he's now 37. He's 38. So I was lying about his age there. He just turned 38. And my birth son is 13. My adopted son is 9. And because I think as an adoptive parent, you cannot cruise. You can't just think, oh, it'll be fine. I started running a series of talks, which we held above a function room in a pub. And that has now turned into, since lockdown, a webinar program called WAF Talks, which is for members of We Are Family.
Fantastic. And may I say the key word that stuck out for me is that this is real support, right? So we often talk about on other episodes of the podcast, we talk about the sort of support that is out there, and a lot of online stuff, a lot of us online stuff on Facebook, which I, as an adoptee, I don't find particularly useful. It doesn't move me on, and I've heard the same about from adopted parents too. And I've been in groups where there's adopted parents and adoptees, and they don't seem to move things on. So this is a real organisation, and one of the things that every adopted parent I've had on the show has said is the importance of support and peer-to-peer support. People who have been in the trenches have thought perhaps that they were just going to cruise through, and it hasn't turned out that way. They've been through some sticky times, they've learned some vital stuff, and they want to share that with other people along the journey. And for me, this is the perfect duo to be on the show, because it fits exactly with what we're trying to do here at Thriving Adoptees, is to catalyze, share learnings and catalyze insights for the listeners. So I think this is going to be a great episode. So if I could start with asking that really open question, really, and maybe it's too big a question, but what have been the most important learnings for you through, and what do you continue to learn through being an adopted parent?
Gosh, that is a very big question. So, I mean, I may ramble a little bit, but I'll try and keep this concise. I think, so obviously at the very beginning, you do lots of training and preparation and you read lots of books and you think it and you possibly overthink it. And then you move from this very academic process to, for us, what was like a week-long process of meeting and practically living in the foster carer's house to actually doing it. And that was a big shock in a sense, because you moved to this permanent commitment in your life, which is probably the most permanent thing you will ever do. And I think, I mean, we learned a lot along the way. I mean, so it was always Stephen's desire to have children. It wasn't necessarily on my radar. Stephen is an educator, is brilliant with children. Children are naturally drawn to him. And then when our first son came, he bonded more with me, which was a terrible shock, both for me and for Stephen. And I remember us, you know, we'd always agreed if we were going to have a disagreement about our parenting, we would go to the end of the garden to do it, so that, you know, there was no divide and rule. And I remember, you know, it used to be that my son, who was then 5, would climb into my lap, and his coping mechanism was often to fiddle with my ear. And I remember Stephen saying, "Stop doing it, stop doing it." I was like, "I'm not doing anything." And that whole attachment thing was really interesting, that it didn't go to plan. And I think my global learning is, going to plan is not going to happen. There is no plan. So you can do all the thinking and learning. You go, yeah, we've got attachment covered and we know how we'll cope with these things. But you have to learn to roll with the punches a bit and deal with situations as they come up. Reverse happened with our second son, very much bonded more with Stephen initially. And that was fine. And it's quite interesting because, and I found that a slightly more struggling process, because I think I understood my second son more, and that was a bit of a rub in our relationship. So my eldest is more like my partner, so I get him and his random stream of consciousness stuff that he says, whereas Aiden is a bit more like me, and perhaps he points out the flaws in me, but we have a great relationship with both the boys. But I think that's to having a plan and then having to realize you can't have a plan. And that's been true through issues around contact. You know, the boys are very different. We had quite a complex time with my eldest during his teen years. So I think it's for me, the overarching thing is not sticking rigidly to this is how to do it. I wish, you know, when we started, there had been communities like We Are Family for us to belong to. There wasn't really anything. Support came from social workers. And I mean, to be honest, we couldn't get away from social workers fast enough in our lives. It didn't seem to be adding real value to what we were doing. But yeah, it would have been nice to talk to other people who were going through some of those experiences, because I think, and Jay has a different journey to this, but for us, the constant question was, is what we're going through because our son is or was a looked after child, or is what we're going through because he's 5? Because we didn't have a benchmark for a lot of this stuff. Second time around, and I think this is possibly true of birth children as well, we were a little bit more cavalier about the whole thing, frankly, having done it once. And I remember conversations with social workers going, yeah, we're not doing the floppy bunny thing on the rug thing. That didn't work for us. Whereas the first time around, we did whatever we were told. So I think, yeah, my learnings are as a parent, not to have a rigid plan, because it'll be thrown out. And secondly, as an adopter going through the process, you can challenge back, actually. You don't just have to follow what you're told to do. And I know first time around, you're really nervous and you want to get it right and you don't want to upset the apple cart. But this is you. This is your commitment forever. And frankly, once you've had your child placed with you for about 6 weeks, you are the expert in that child, more so than any social worker who has ever been in their life. And you can speak with confidence in the way that they can't. So that's my global bit with a little bit of anecdote in the middle.
Yeah, brilliant. I've got a few questions on that, but I'd love to hear your global take, Jay. That would be brilliant.
Okay, so our son was 4 when he came to us. And my oldest son, who was my birth son, was 8. So we had been looking to adopt since he was five. And I think he kind of thought, well, it's actually never going to happen. It's some kind of fantasy that mum and dad have got going on. But, you know, I'll humour them. So he was full of beans when he was five. By the time he was eight, he was slightly jaded. And then this child comes along and it's real. It's happening. And so we went along to meet him. And I remember the first time he called my husband, Nick, dad, straight away. And during the introductions, one time when Nick couldn't make it, he literally turned to me and said, I don't want to be with you. So I said, that's a very brave thing for you to say. And I said, and thank you for telling me. I said, but I really want to be with you. And you know, hopefully over time you'll change your mind about me. He was really anti the woman and really focused on having male mentors, if you like, in his life. It didn't take long for that to turn around, but I'm not sure how much of an advantage that really was, because things were extremely difficult. I think my older son had imagined this playmate that he'd have. And what we had was a little boy who felt rejected by his foster carers because he just didn't understand why they didn't want to keep him, because they loved him. They told him they loved him. They supported him in lots of ways. We still have a lovely relationship with them 5 years on. But it's a difficult concept, isn't it? Why don't they want to keep me? And so he felt not only abandoned, or because he'd been removed from his birth parents, and so there was that huge loss. He also felt the huge loss of his foster carers. And so he was confused, angry, frustrated, and at the same time wanted to present as a happy chappy and kind of comply a fair bit. So there was this ball of not one direction going on, and anything could happen at any time. And I think the thing that I have learned, and I am still learning, is that you really do need to get down to the height of your child and experience the world a little bit from his point of view. And actually, it is complicated, but it is much easier if you attempt to do that. Because under all this bluster and rage and sometimes destruction and violence, there's such a lot of fear and there's such a lot of sadness. And when you look at it through that kind of those goggles, you don't get so cheesed off, because you know his motivation is not to upset you, but for his feelings to be expressed in some way that the outer world can understand. So I think when you adopt, I mean, even a baby, this is a complicated bunch of cells and you need to evolve together. And I think that you need to show yourself willing to be with them in a very real way. With my older son, I used to spend a fair amount of time in groups with other kids, with other adults, and I had a whale of a time. I didn't need to keep too much of an eye on him. It is not the same when you have an adopted child. You really need to keep your eye on what's going on, what shifts in mood are taking place, where his tolerance window is shrinking. You need to be aware of all these things. So you can't really in the same way go and have a coffee with your mates and let the kids play in the park. It's a more engaging process, and you need to be a parent who's aware.
Yeah. So I'm going to change tack slightly to where I thought I was going. Mark, did your boys feel rejected?
Yes, actually. I mean, both have very different and quite complex stories. So my eldest His birth father had already, there was, he has a brother. His birth father split up from his birth mother, had then formed another relationship, and they'd had a second child. My son was taken into care because of continual neglect. Sadly, his mother died whilst he was in care. So he had a brief period of time where he lived with his birth father. They decided they couldn't cope with three children, so they effectively gave him up to the care system, but then went on to have another child. So not only was he rejected once, but twice, and then the reason for the second rejection was then removed by them having a third child. So his relationship with his father has been very complicated, and he's still, I think, struggling to work out what that relationship is. We did try and support a lot of contact through certainly his earlier years. It's not in a great place at the moment. He's decided that actually they add no value to his life. Whereas with my youngest, there were many, many siblings and half siblings, some very complicated family relationships. Some of whom had, I think one had been taken into care, some were with grandma. He was the one who was formally taken into care. So again, it's that why me not and not the others kind of thing. Contact has been much more difficult to manage because the social work team wouldn't facilitate that, which left Stephen and I in the situation of loco parentis with someone else's teenage children, which felt somewhat uncomfortable. So I think at the heart of it, there is a sense of rejection and confusion, to be honest, as to trying to understand why things happened. And we have a certain amount of information from obviously the files that one gets and sees. We have more, I think, context for my eldest because we were able to have contact with the birth, certainly with the birth dad. But I think, yeah, it underscores, and I think certainly in teenage years, certainly resurfaced for my eldest son that sense of identity. And we've had quite a tricky few years, of which we are coming out of now. And I think he's really clear who are the important factors in his life.
Yeah. So, because it is the fundamental challenge I see in adoptees groups feeling rejected. It was for me the the key flash of anger that came out of the blue when I was 40, it came out as with a lot more expletives, and I don't swear on the show, but so I won't swear. But she didn't love me, my birth mother. She didn't love me enough to keep me. She gave me this consolation prize, this teddy bear, right? But it came out with venom. It came from nowhere, that thought. And it came with venom, and it came with anger, and it came with a sense of resentment towards my birth mother. And luckily, the person that I was with when I shared that just said to me, "I'm a mum myself, Simon, and I don't think it was quite like that." And with that, the volcano of the lava that was spewing forth from the volcano of anger with those words immediately stopped, and there was a little bit of smoke coming out of the top, but the volcano, the torrent of trauma, it ceased immediately because of the way that I. Because of the insight that I had into the fact that, I've never had that thought before, and this mother, you know, gave it to me deadpan, and using another metaphor, the balloon of anger popped, and it popped there and then, it's gone, right? What I see in an adult adoptees, a lot of the adult adoptees are the ones that are, you know, that are going in these groups. I see that anger as a far more as a permanent thing, and that feeling of rejection. How have you dealt with that feeling of rejection? What has worked? What's been the flip side of that? I don't even know how to answer the question. Don't ask the question in a really succinct way. Then how have you tackled that feeling of rejection in your own kids?
I'm happy to go, and then Jay, if that's okay. So with us, we have always been very open about the boys' backgrounds, and have tried to have those conversations with them when they've asked. We've never concealed. I mean, it's quite hard with two dads to conceal. You know, we are not the birth family. Also, they were pretty much fully formed at five when they came to us. So we've kept, you know, the photo albums that we inherited, which include birth family stuff, sit amongst the wider photo albums, pictures around the house. We've talked about it. We've worked really hard around contact. And also, as they grow up and questions come up, to talk about them openly and honestly, to try and never to demonize the birth family, because they are not necessarily bad people. They can be nice people to whom bad things happen or complex worlds exist. And to recognize for the boys that actually, you know, adults make decisions and they're not always good ones, but we are here, we love them. We have actively chosen this path. We actively chose them as our sons. And we will always be here for them. And, you know, you get in those early years a little bit of pushing that to see if that's true. We have always maintained, you know, the whole bags of love thing. And I think in the early years, it's very confusing for the children, because they, whilst feeling resentful or confused, all of those things, they still have affection. And particularly when we were seeing birth dad, it's like, well, how do I, can I still love my birth dad? Can I call him dad if I've got these dads? And it's like, yeah, of course you can, darling. There's plenty of love to go around, you know. That's absolutely fine. So I think it was, for us, it was trying to always be open and honest and to have those conversations, not to conceal things, not to demonize, and to try and understand the world, as Jay said, from their perspective. I mean, my father and my mother divorced when I was seven. So I have a sense of somebody making a choice where I was less important in the equation than someone else. And I know that, in a sense, you do carry that through your life. It's like, you know, it's I have a great relationship with my father, but, you know, it's a thing, it's a moment in my life that somebody made a decision where I was less important, and for the boys that will, I suspect, always be a thing that they are aware of. What we have tried to do is to counterbalance that with a lot of love and understanding and respect.
Just before we go on to you on that question, Jay, if I may ask you, Mark, have you shared that story with your boys? The story of your parents splitting up as a kind of a, as an entry point, and did that land for them? Did that?
To the degree that one ever gets coherent emotional responses from a young boy / teenage boy, yeah, I think it's there. They're aware of it in their life, that actually I have some sense. I don't claim to fully understand what they know and have been through, but I think just by continuing those conversations, and it was interesting when my eldest brought his girlfriend back for the first time, here, his new girlfriend, the first thing he did was go to all the family albums, both the hours and his birth parents, because he wanted to contextualize his past.
Yeah.
But the nice thing was he felt able to do that.
Yeah.
That it's not a problem to talk about his birth family in front of us. So
I found the reason I asked the question about you sharing your own stuff is because I did a lot of, before I came into the adoption space, I did worked in schools, primary schools, with about 1,600 kids. And I would, we were talking about their emotional intelligence, their happiness, where happiness comes from. And one of the main things that affects, or the biggest cause of kids' unhappiness, I'm talking about the general population here, not adoptee specific, the biggest causes of kids' unhappiness is actually bullying. And when I shared my story, I showed a couple of sentences about my story of being the victim of bullying when I was around their age and how that had made me feel, that was incredibly engaging for them, because I felt, I got the sense that I was, you know, to use linking to what Jay was saying, I was entering their world. I was sharing a piece of my world that related to their world, and they gained great empathy, kudos, whatever. I got the feeling that they hadn't heard a lot of adults opening up about emotional stuff with them, and that created a bond. You know, it was almost like a badge of honor for them, and I found that really. And I'm, because me and my wife haven't got kids, I'm always intrigued to hear to what extent parents share their own stuff as a way of being open about what's they've been going on, and it's the bridge to empathy with our kids. You know, this is obviously this isn't the same, but I do have it's not just a thing that informs where you're coming from, but it also is something that is an incredible bond building tool to share what we've been through. So Jay, how would you, I mean, if you want to comment on that, great. If you'd rather just go on to the, you know, how you dealt with this rejection stuff.
I think that sharing your own experiences of whatever went on for you as a child. My son is going through a period of hating school. I've just found out what this is all about. It's not about bullying, but he wakes up every morning and says, I don't want to go to school. And I didn't like school when I was a kid. And I said, I didn't like school either, you know? So I completely get it. I'm not trying to change what he's feeling, because I have to understand and respect that those are his feelings. And so they're not wrong to have. But how can we make life a bit better whilst doing the things that are required of us? And one of those things is going to school. You know, I wouldn't say it like that, but that's what we're kind of aiming to do. I'm writing a story for him at the moment where he's the star, and it's all about going to school and all the other things that can mitigate that as if you like, the thing that he doesn't like. But I haven't finished yet. So I'm in the middle of that. But, you know, I think, yeah, I share with him that I didn't like going to school. And I think he feels somewhat comforted by that. And it's interesting, actually, because as a child, you really have so few choices. You have to go to school. You have to listen to what is being said to you. You have to conform. But you know, as an adult, the minute you leave school, you can actually start to shape your own world. And all those badges that children may have been given, like the ADHD badge, they fall away because it's less relevant when you're an adult and you are in control of your own environment. So it's really interesting that you can be a very successful person with ADHD, but it seems to be such a big problem for schools to deal with. But most schools are not trauma informed, and Mark knows I bang the drum about this a fair bit. But anyway, in terms of dealing with him feeling rejected, I am, and we are, just as Mark is, as open and honest and real as we can possibly be about where he's come from, who his parents are, and who his foster carers are and how much they still care about him. We have an ongoing relationship with his foster carers. We went to Israel to their daughter's wedding last March. I mean, you know, this is a lovely relationship. And these are actually really beautiful people that we feel very lucky to have in our lives. And he said to me, but you wouldn't know them, when I said, what beautiful people, you wouldn't even know them if it wasn't for me. And I said, yes, darling, that is absolutely true. You know, yet another reason I am grateful that you're in my life. But we went to see them when tensions were a bit relieved about COVID last year in the summertime. So we had a meal outside in a cafe. And I said to him, look, the foster carer, the dad, is really unwell. And so I said, look, you know, we're trying to keep our distance and, you know, we need to be careful and all of that. And he said, well, they're my family. He said, they're my family too. So of course I'm not going to keep my distance. Of course I'm going to be close to them. And anyway, I shared this with the foster carers and they were just really thrilled that he felt like that. So in some ways, he does still feel part of their family. I think that hurt and feeling of rejection has dissipated over time. Obviously, the primal wound is always going to be within him. And to address that, we are very much hoping to meet face to face with his birth mum in the Easter holidays of this year. So we have a plan going forward and he knows about that plan, so that this is not a mysterious woman from the past. It can be a perfectly sort of practical arrangement to see his mum, and hopefully over time he can become just bored and dismissive of her as he is of every other adult in his life. And so it's not such a big, you know, mystery to him. So that's how we're dealing with it. But, you know, when we talk, we are real, honest, and as open as we can be.
Yeah. Wow, there's so much in there. I'll do the easy bit first. Okay, so I have a completely different take on the primal wound, and I talk about it a lot, and I talk about it. There's another episode on it. There's a few episodes on the podcast about it, so I'm not going to go into it here. But I'm going to put some links into the show notes. So I use this phrase, the show notes. So it's the description that's with the podcast. And in those links, you'll find links to the social links for Jay and Mark and the company, the organization, the charity's website. So you can do that. But you'll also find, I'm talking to you listeners, you also find links to my take on the primal wound. So I'm not going to go into that now. The first thing is, you said something about, I'm going to join up two things that you said, Jay. So you started off that last segment by talking about trying to change anybody's feelings. Now, this is, from my perspective, a fairly futile task, trying to change. And it's futile, it's invalidating, it's disrespectful, but we all want to do it, don't we? And that lady that helped me with my stuff and my anger with them, she was trying to change my feelings. Was she trying to change my feelings? She was just saying, no, I think it was like this. Yeah. But when you talked about what your son said to you when Nick wasn't there, about him saying, I don't want to, she said, you said something like, he said, I don't want to be with you. You didn't try and change his feelings. Mm. You met with him and you actually praised him for being bold enough to say that. Now,
I I think it was a very brave thing to say.
And I think that braveness came in from who you are, from your kind of like your emotional strength. And it came in the moment. It was, you know, wisdom in the moment. And I realize there's, we're all Brits here, so we're not really good at compliments, right? But that's how it would say to me. And you know, Mark's talked about overthinking rather than going with the flow and being cavalier. We're not talking about being cavalier here. We're talking about you said about the plan goes out the window, and the thing that popped into my head then is a boxer's analogy. Once said, you know, I think it was Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan about how they're going to fight me until I punch them on the nose, something like that. You know, and Patton said, you know, you've got to have a plan, but you've got to be able to throw the plan out the window. You can't plan for over it. As we overthink, it seems to be part of the human condition, is overthinking, and you can't plan for every occasion. And you don't need to, because luckily you've got wisdom on your side, and wisdom's going to give you answers in the moment. But we're not really educated in that way. We're not brought up on this wisdom. But you guys have been going with wisdom all the way. And that's the thing you've got, you know, you were another word. One of my mentors talks about this is, you know, everybody says, oh, we're just winging it. But you're winging it, but you were born with wings on, and the wings are going to help you fly. So it's there. The wisdom's underneath, and it's underneath all the overthinking. And this is about practice rather than theory. For me, the key bit is helping the child understand why what happened. So there's a logic behind it. So and I loved what Mark said about separating out the difference between bad people and bad things. You know, one of the stuff I always used to do with kids in schools is get them to see why people do what they do. So people do so that there is a rationale. It's not about a bad person. It's about somebody being that's in their circumstances, what's going on within their heads. You know, we act the way that we do because of the way that we feel in that moment. And I used to relate this to the bully. So the bully is angry or scared. That's why they act like they act to you, the victim of bullying. And therefore, it's not personal. It's about what's going on for the other person. It's not about us. Bullies make it about us. So I was bullied for having buck teeth, right? Or being not very practical and scant. They made it about me, but it was never about me. It was always about them and what they've been, they've been through. So for me, one of the most empowering things is for kids to see why people do the stuff that they do. And then and that is that is the logic that underpins, that helps us wobble the taking the rejection personally stuff. That was a long comment. It makes perfect sense to me, but does it make sense to you guys?
Yeah.
Because as a child, you don't have that wealth of experience to understand why people behave the way they do. As one grows up and gets older, you have context for things. You also have your own catalogue of things that you might have done better the second time around, or things that you wish you hadn't have done, your own mistakes, the times that you have either deliberately or inadvertently hurt other people. So if you have anything of a reflective nature, you start to reflect that, you know, there but for the grace of something go I, that, you know, I'm no perfect human being, this, I am very fallible, I have made mistakes. And that helps me understand potentially the journeys that other people have gone on, and therefore to be able to help other people, and particularly my children, understand, well, yeah, we get it wrong. As parents, as human beings, as partners, we make mistakes, we do things, or we do things for the right reasons, but not in the right way. So that's part of the process of growing up. And it's that old adage, you know, if I knew everything I knew now, but had the body I had when I was 20 and my knees didn't hurt, life would be amazing. But sadly, we have to live forward rather than backwards. So yeah, you're right. It is about all of those things. And I think continuing to have those conversations, to treat your children as young grown-ups, as young people, not as this thing that you can control or mold, because you can't. We know you can never change an adult's mind, so why we think we can change a child's mind, it always baffles me, or change what they're feeling. What we can do is say, we sort of understand what you're feeling, and that's fine. And, you know, that's how you feel the world and experience it. But perhaps offer a little bit of context to some of those things, just to make them see things in a slightly different way.
Yeah. So what have you learned about, another massive question for you, right? So what have you learned about yourselves, and what do you continue to learn about yourselves as you go through this continuous learning?
So, I'll let you go first, Jay.
Okay. So I think that I was lucky enough to have a really great relationship with my stepson, who was 19 when I met him. And he has had a tricky kind of journey in his life. And I just think that as a birth mum, I had, you know, my older son, my middle son, let's say. And so I just was going through life thinking, you know, that I could fix things. You can't fix things. So I have learned you can't fix things. You have to be in the moment. You have to be with the problem, and you have to help your children to find solutions for themselves whilst giving them the support that they need to get there. And also, you know, I think that I was quite critical. I hate to say this about myself, but I think I really was. You know, the other night when my young son said, because I'd said, let's get into bed now, darling, after being in his bedroom for half an hour trying to put him to bed. Right, that's it, he said. I'm leaving. Now, we're really careful about tone with my son. So there was no tone when I said that. I had the storybook, I had everything ready, and I just said, please, let's get into bed now, because, you know, I've got the book. And he was like, right, I'm leaving. So he got loads of stuff out of the wardrobe, and he was leaving home. And I said, oh gosh, that makes me so sad. And I'm really going to miss you. I don't know what I'm going to do without you if you leave. Packing away. So I left the room. I came back 5 minutes later and I said, so do you need any help? So he said, I've got my pants. I've got my fluffy socks. I've got my socks. He went through all the bits that he had. So I said, so where are you going? And he said, the garden. And I said, really? I said, with all the foxes and the rats. And his face just absolutely crumbled. And I said, I'd much rather you stay in here with me. And then he went through all his friends' houses that he was going to go to. And he just needed to exhaust himself with this fantasy of leaving, I think. But, you know, I didn't try and fix it. I just let him run through what he needed to run through. And then when we went to bed, He said, I can't go to sleep. And I said, you don't need to go to sleep. You just need to rest. And that's fine. If you're resting and you're not sleeping, it's fine. But he said, I can't sleep because I keep thinking I have to leave. But this is your home. So you never have to leave this place. This is your home. And so it's about, you know, my previous self would have been, don't be so daft. I would have, do you know what I mean? I would have done everything wrong. I'm not saying I did everything right this time, but I allowed him to do what he needed to do instead of trying to take control and steer things back in the direction that I wanted them to go. And it just makes me feel quite guilty for the first few years of my other son's life. Was I this big controlling creature? I don't think I was, but I could have been. Do you know what I mean? But I am far more patient and understanding. And instead of saying, look at the mess on your floor, I just said to him, I love you so much. And I can't tell you how simple, it's not simple to do, because you are thinking, bloody hell, there's a big mess on the floor. You barely, there's an inch just to walk on. But actually focusing on him has such a fantastic reason. It's almost like he blossoms. It's like you see him flower. Because you have ignored all that rubbish and you're actually focused on the only really important thing in the room, which is your relationship with him and what he means to you. And sometimes, because life is a little bit messy and there are other stresses within it, we miss the opportunity to do that. I would say to any parent anywhere, always grab the opportunity, because you're never going to be on your deathbed thinking, I wish I'd picked those socks up from the floor. You're always going to be, that's the relationship I had with my children.
Wow, that's a beautiful story.
I completely agree with everything that Jay has said, with one exception, which is the messiness of a 19-year-old's bedroom floor, where I do say, clear it up now. I do still love you, but really, this is a hazard zone now. This is a health issue. Yeah, because I will, I mean, I it's really interesting. So I was thinking about what am I still learning? And what you said, Jay, is absolutely true. I am a fixer by trade. I was trained as a stage manager. Fixing things and ordering the universe is in my DNA. And that is what I did as a parent. I am the one who, you know, sorts the doctors, the dentists, remembers this. I don't know if I have made my children incompetent. I mean, they can cook, which is good. They can, my eldest son can iron. But I still find myself being the person who they come to, and I have to resist ordering their lives, because particularly now they're over 18. I can't fix stuff because I can't, you know, they are grown-ups. And it's that transition from being a parent where you can fix the universe for younger children to the parent of older sons, where actually my role now is to quote Neil Bartlett, to be ready to catch them when they fall. I have to watch them do things where you just go, well, I wouldn't have done that, and bite my tongue and not engage, because, you know, other parts of my family still want to engage and run my life, and it's not helpful. But the boys know that if it all goes horribly, horribly wrong, we will be there. We will pick up the pieces, be they financial, emotional, whatever. But I can't control them or their universe. And I think had I have learned some of that earlier in the process, not that we ever had major heads. I possibly did more with my younger son. We'd had less of those slightly tension points where I was trying to fix things, but he probably thought I was trying to control the universe. And we are very, very similar in character. So there's a bit of a two Taurians butting heads against each other. But you're right. It's but no one tells you have to learn this stuff along the way. So I completely agree, apart from the messy floors, it drives me insane. The amount of cans, empty drink cans, strewn across the floor.
Yeah, I'm not at that stage yet.
Yeah. For me, there's something here about going back to that feeling rejected is kind of like, well, that might be the past, but we're never going to reject you.
Yeah.
I did that uncharacteristically, with uncharacteristic brevity for me. And I'm just wondering whether you could flesh that out, because what I'm putting forward there is a theory, and you guys are coming from practice. So could you flesh that out? Does that?
I hope my boys realize that we will never reject them. I mean, there is, you know, it's an interesting question, isn't it? That there are no certainties in life. The one certainty I have is that I will always be the father to my children. You know, there is no certainty that Stephen and I will be together forever, because one cannot see into the future. I think we will, you know. But the one thing that is clear, and has been clear since the day my eldest arrived, this is the one commitment I have made, which is lifelong, that is immutable. And we say it has been tested. It has been tested in some quite extreme circumstance that, you know, there have been days where I've said, I don't like you very much at the moment, but I still love you hugely, because it's been quite testing. And a lot of that anger has come from fear and about what they're doing to themselves and their futures. So I think as they grow up, the scales of emotional hurt and love will shift, that one becomes less dominant. I don't think it will always be a thing that informs who you are, like all the significant events in your life shape you as a human being. And that's not necessarily in a negative way. You are the summation of everything you have lived and been. And when I was at drama school, a brilliant man who was the head of my course said, well, these are the things that shape your actual signature, who you are as a human being. But as you grow over, you get more loops and curves on your signature. And, you know, I could look at a show done by Ken Bennett-Hunter as production manager, and even not knowing he'd done it, you could see his signature was all over in the way that people behave. And so I think these things inform our life, and we learn from them and grow. But I don't think they never vanish, but they become contextualized within everything else, which is more positive. I mean, I became much more self-sufficient because my mother was a single parent, because my father had left, and I had to step into the breach and probably grow up faster than I should have done. I don't see that as a negative in my life. You know, I have a good relationship with my father now. It is just part of my life now. And I hope for the boys that as they grow through life and they accumulate more experiences and more positive relationships, it puts into context their past, but also underscored by the continued presence of Stephen and I in their lives.
Beautiful. Mm.
So I suppose my son is 9, and we have he's just started music therapy, and we were chatting ahead of this beginning with the music therapist and talking about attachment. And my husband said, well, you know, we think that at some points in his early life, he must have had a good relationship with his mum because he's managed to attach to us. But I said, because we have said that in the past, and I think that that is true, but his attachment to us is not solid. And I know that. And it wavers and it becomes and it shifts and it's not. So I think what's going on with my son is that intellectually he understands that he is part of this family. He understands that we are his forever parents and this is his forever home. But I think that emotionally, we still have a way to go for him to feel that he truly belongs. So he wants to, I think all the ingredients are there, but he can't bring it together or they're being mixed, but the cake is not being baked for the moment. And I think when he is older, that understanding through his own, I suppose, emotional maturity as he grows and his relationships with others, such as friends and, you know, then a girlfriend or a boyfriend, we don't know what will happen in his future. So when he starts having feelings in relationships other than this one, perhaps he will then start to understand his emotional world with us better. I don't know, but I have a very strong feeling that he's not, you know, my other son, it's like chalk and cheese, the whole, I completely get, you know, where he is. But the thing is, I'm very tuned into my adopted son too. So I know where he's coming from. I kind of move with his moods and, you know, and mostly get it kind of right. But I just think that we have a way to go before we can say that he's properly attached to us after 5 years.
Would you like my opinion on that?
Yes, please.
Well, I'll take back to a meta or a global thing, right? So what changes us, all of us, is insights. So for me, the insight about my birth mother, and then a later insight about her, her love for me, that I had whilst reading a letter from her to the adoption council agency time about the teddy bear, which I felt her desperation for her predicament. I felt her her love for me in the letter and how she wanted to keep me, but she couldn't. It was a visceral experience that had me flooding in tears, with washing away all my, well, washing away my my feeling of being rejected, and a connection with her through a piece of paper that she'd written 50 years before I read it. And it was essentially, it was an insight. My view of her and my view of my own view of her changed. So what changes is, what changes us as our take on the world is when we have an insight. And, you know, insights happen inside. They happen within us. And some of them are small, like an insightlet. Some of them are huge. If you're religious, some people might call it an epiphany, a eureka moment. So the name of the game, the name of the game with the Thriving Adoptees podcast is to catalyze insights. And the name of the game with your son is to catalyze insights. So he sees his relationship with you, or his attachment with you, or his future with you, whatever you want to say. So he sees that for himself. Because we have to insights come from inside, so we have to have them. We have to have them for ourselves. There's no such thing as a secondhand epiphany. You can't go to a store and buy it and give it to your son. You can't go, I can't go to store. You can't go on Amazon and get one and send it to you in the post, you know. So he has to have them for himself. So it's hanging out at the bus stop for insights. It's prompting insights in your son. And that is what will lead to the change that you're looking for.
I know. I was thrilled the other night, I have to say, after the leaving episode. I was lying on his bed with him, and he was very sleepy, and he flopped his arm over my neck, and he said, "You're the best mum in the world." And I just thought, oh my God, how beautiful is that? So, you know, I don't know how to make the insights happen, but I'm
You do, though, actually. Because what can be stronger than that, what you just said, right? We're not good. We're British, okay? We're not very good at modesty. I asked people, you know, saw somebody and, yeah, la, 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 la. I said, how's the modesty going? Do you know what I mean? How's the modesty going, right? So you know exactly how to do it. You're doing it. You're doing it instinctively. You're doing it, you know, you're coming from wisdom. It's not a thought out strategy, you know, the stuff that you did. And it really touched me, actually, because I was going to share you my story about me running away, right? Right. So I'd been at a friend's house for the weekend. I was maybe 10. It was summer, not winter when we're recording this, or when that thing happened to you. I decided that I wanted to go back to my buddy's house for some reason. You know, I don't know why. I can't remember the thought, but I can remember getting about a quarter of a mile from home, bursting into tears and running back. And I don't know what happened afterwards.
How old were you then?
10.
Okay.
I think I was about 10. I might have been slightly younger, might be slightly. But you know how to, you don't just know how to do what you're doing. You don't just know. He had that moment. You're the best mum.
I know. I thought about that earlier. Yes.
Yeah. So all I'd encourage you to do is to do more of what you're doing. I mean, it's the old thing, you know, do more of what you're doing. Do more, try new things, do more of what works and do less of what doesn't. I mean, that's the theory. Everybody's looking for a silver bullet in running our businesses, running a charity, in parenting. Everybody's looking for the silver bullet, you know, the one thing. And that is the one thing. Do more of what works, do less of what doesn't work, and move on. But the world knows that we are the selling people, the people selling us stuff, even if they're selling us therapy, right? They know that we are uncertain, and they know that we're impatient. So they put this stuff out onto us. Like, I was just the way you were. Yeah. Then I learned this. And then if you spend time with me, if you spend money with you, I'll tell you that. And well, as Mark said, within 6 weeks or so, we're the world's expert on our kids. The people coming from theory. People coming from theory and people coming from practice are chalk and cheese. That's why I'm asking you. I'm coming from a point of theory, but I'm embracing your practice and I'm trying to bring your practice out. And I'm waffling a little bit as well, so I apologize.
It's good waffle.
It's self-deprecation. It's British. It's modest. It's kind of baked into us, isn't it? You know, I point out on you, and then I point out on myself. You know, and that's empathy. You know, I mean, that's the whole thing. Like, if empathy is the connection, it's the connection. That's why we share the stories. We share our stories with kids. We share when we felt the same way as with kids, because they then realize, you know, you talked about not wanting to go to school. So we don't invalidate their experience. We meet them where they're at, and then we help them move them on. Not trying to change their feelings, but trying to move them gently on and help them see their own stuff for themselves. They've got to see it for themselves. And when your son says you're the best mum in the world, he has seen that for himself.
Bear in mind, this is just about an hour after he said, "You're not my real mum." Yeah, I could have ruined the moment by asking him to put all the stuff away.
Wow.
I didn't, though. I didn't.
Sorry, no, I was just smiling at Jay's comment about not getting him to put all the stuff away. it probably would have ruined the moment.
Yeah, for sure.
Have you guys got anything you'd like to ask me before we wrap up?
I've got lots to ask you, but you're going to come and do a webinar soon, so withhold my questions so that all can be revealed in the webinar. But thank you.
Thank you.
If I suppose I have one question. I mean, if your adoptive parents could have done one thing differently, which would have been significant for you, what would that have been? What would you have liked them to have done differently?
That's a brilliant question. Nothing comes to mind, really.
Can you save that question in your mind for the webinar?
I asked the question is because I think for lots of adoptive parents, we are constantly, where we started this conversation, we're constantly planning, thinking, worrying, overthinking, worrying that we're not doing it well. And actually, I think most adoptive parents are doing it brilliantly because they are actively thinking about parenting. And then learning the confidence to not go to plan. And if you go to what Jay said at the very beginning about try and see everything through the child's eyes, you will understand the universe so much better. I mean, if you put yourself in someone else's shoes, you understand their journey so much better. So it is, I asked the question because I think we constantly say, could I do this better? And actually, we're probably all doing it quite well. And actually, we are still human in this space and fallible. And so I think being nice to ourselves is a thing that I think all parents should probably remember to be nice to themselves in that space. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to ask me what the one thing that I completely agree with you. And I've done a lot of work with non-adoptive parents. Okay. And they ain't anything like as curious or as open as you guys. And I mean, I don't just mean you guys. I mean all the guys listening, and all the other adopted parents. They are hungry. They are curious. They are you summed up in two words, but I can't remember what they were. But yeah, they're far more active in this, you know. And that's a great thing. They're far more intentional. I think probably that's a good word. They're far more intentional. I would say is if it's one thing that I think that we all need to do, right? Whether we're adopted parents, whether we're parents, whether we're not parents, is we need to do our own work. We need to do our own work in whatever way works best for us. We need to understand who we truly are. We need to understand our identity. and our identity. I don't mean our name, because you're talking to Simon Ben, but I was David Anthony Flower. Okay, so you know, we aren't our name, because that changes. We aren't our role. So I'm now a podcaster, you know, but I, you know, I haven't always done that. So that can't be the essence of who I am. We aren't our past, because that's something that's happened to us. We aren't our thoughts or our feelings, because they come and go and they don't take us with them. But that essence of self, that the ghost in the machine, the diamond hidden in the manure of our thinking and our feelings, the diamond in the manure of things that we've been through, the perfection of who we are, the unconditioned mind. There's lots of different words for this. Consciousness, spirit. The one I often talk about is the fact that we are spiritual beings. We're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience. And you look at that spiritual being, abbreviate that to spirit, that essence of who we truly are. That's what I think, that's where the ultimate leverage for our inner game, how we relate internally, and for our outer game, how we relate with our kids, our partners, the world, our employer, our employees, our friends, whatever. So yeah, that would be my ultimate is to, and I practice what I preach on that. I do that. That is that curiosity about the truth of who we are, underneath our thoughts and our feelings, underneath our experiences, underneath what we've been through in life. That is an area that fascinates me, and where I pour a lot of time into that stuff. That's a long answer to a short question. And I was supposed to save it. I was supposed to be sharing it for you, Jed, but hey-ho.
No, it's all good.
That make any sense? Because it can be a bit esoteric for some people.
It makes sense.
The fundamentally unwoundable part of, sorry, the fundamentally unwoundable essence of who we truly are. Because I don't subscribe to the primal wound.
Yeah, I need to listen to your podcast about that.
Yeah, I'll send you a link. I'll put the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. It's been a superb conversation. I've absolutely really delighted and enjoyed it. And I'm looking at the clock here. We've been on for like an hour and a quarter. So time flies when you're having fun.
Thank you, Simon. It's been great. And it's been great to share this with Jay as well.
Yeah.
Always fun for us.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you, Matt. And thank you, listeners. We'll see you. We'll speak to you again very soon. Thank you.